So we are picking up this week where we left off last week, which we didn't get to the end of chapter 21 because there was more discussion last week. So we're going to pick up starting in verse 7 of Exodus 21 this week. And I need to turn off my Wi-Fi so I can quit getting messages. All right. Exodus 21, verses 7 through 11 is where we start. And I'm going to do it like I have been doing. I'll just make the comments, and then if you guys have questions or statements afterwards, just, you know, chime right on in then. a Hebrew girl might be sold to another man, not so much as a slave, but as a maidservant or a house servant, with the intention that she eventually become his wife or the wife of his son when she reaches the age of maturity, which in their day was about 12 years of age. Well, actually, 12 years and a day. That's when you were marriable as a young girl. Couldn't be on, had to be literally 12 years and a day. So, and that was very likely, historically speaking, the best idea that we have of how old Mary was when God impregnated her. She was about 12 years old. So it's only our culture that creates weird things about that. We look at that, we think, well, that's just not moral. Right. Well, it's, well, not moral to an American. But not that we have to be careful about saying what's not moral absolutely. You know what I mean? Because God, the bottom line is that Ecclesiastes speaks to this as well. And he says that, it says, do not awaken love until it pleases or before it pleases. And another passage in the Bible talks about that a girl has got to be past the flower of her age, which essentially means she has already had to have begun her period. She has to have already crossed that line. And it says, and so it must be. And so it was a general guideline. It wasn't an absolute, but one way or the other, it was accepted. Because there are girls that can happen with even earlier than 12, but from their perspective, it had to be at least 12 years and one day before it could be considered. Very likely, of course, if she had not reached that point of puberty before 12 years and a day, she probably would not have been considered, but I don't know exactly anywhere that it's very super specific about that. But you had something, Terry, yes?
Just another comment about the culture, that mm-hmm. it was in that culture that God saw that that was okay, mm-hmm. that was what was necessary there, and they were raised so differently than we are.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And in our culture today, I don't believe God would say that to our certain culture the way it is. There would have to be changes for that to make sense.
Yeah, well, I mean, he would not do that in America because America has already got, it would hurt their own personal conscience. It would fall into a Romans 14 thing, you know, where one person thinks it's okay to eat meat, another person doesn't. Let each person be convicted in their own mind of their right. God would not seek to compromise someone's personal conscience as long as it doesn't go against his word. But I do want to, that does bring up a good first mention of this, and that is that we do need to understand that these laws have nothing to do with culture. Nothing to do with culture. Are you following? God was establishing what this culture was going to be. Are you following? So that's very important. And this is, and the reason why I capitalize on that, and I've done it before and I'm doing it again now, is because there's such a movement in the body of Christ to set aside certain doctrines or to look at things in the Old Testament with an incredulous gaze, questioning whether it really was God that said these things or whether God was just accepting it because it was already a Jewish custom. And you need to understand, these guys, there was no such thing as a Jewish custom. You realize when they went into Egypt, there was no nation of Jews. There was a family of Jews. They didn't have a national custom. They barely had a family, right, when they first went into bondage in Egypt. And during the 400 years they were there, they're in bondage to another group of people who thought nothing like this. So if they were going to, if these laws were based on the customs they knew, they would all be Egyptian customs. Are you following? So we need to understand that even if they rub us the wrong way, God's saying, I'm telling you, this is right. Are you following? So this is very, very important. And I can't overstate that enough because I'm telling you, if you haven't run into it yet, I'm hoping that you're going to get out into the world enough and among other Christians other than the ones that just meet in our church enough that by the end of the year, you're going to run into this. Because it's everywhere. Christians, a lot of Christians, believe and demonize most of the Old Testament and sections of the New, writing it off as, well, they only did that because it was custom. Like, I'll give you another example. The only reason why God sent Jesus as a male and the only reason why Jesus only picked male apostles is because no one would have listened to a female. And so it was a customary issue, and therefore that's the reason why God did it. It was a very pragmatic decision on God's part. That's not true. And in fact, it doesn't even have any basis in historical fact, because if you remember in the book of Acts, it talks about the fact that in order to stop the proliferation of the gospel, one of the things that the Jews stirred up were prominent women to speak against the gospel. Why would they do that if women didn't have a voice in that day? That makes no sense. So it doesn't even fit historical facts. Are you following me?
Yes.
So, you know, if God said it, and it's in the law here, know that God is the one that came up with it. He didn't take a survey across the planet and ask what man's opinion was, because he frankly didn't care. Are you following?
Yes.
So I say that, I am pressing it rather hard, but I think it's, if you knew what I knew, you'd know how necessary it is to press this issue. If God says it, it's because it's his opinion.
Yes.
He was not influenced by the culture. God, in fact, was influencing the culture en masse. You need to realize that until these laws were written down, if you were to look at some of the ideas that mankind came up with on their own apart from the Ten Commandments, you would be amazed at the lack of morality on this planet before the Ten Commandments showed up. And when they showed up, the Ten Commandments literally has influenced this whole planet. So God was influencing the culture. The culture was not influencing God. That just can't be said enough. So anyway, a Hebrew girl might be sold to another man, not so much as a slave, but as a maidservant, a house servant, with the intention that she become the wife of the man who purchased her or the wife of his son when she reached the age of maturity, being about 12 years and a day. This selling of one's daughter would most likely only occur if her family were in financial difficulty. That's not the only reason, but it is most likely the most common reason it would have been done. You need to understand, again, this would not have been seen as a terrible thing. Especially, you also need to understand how close-knit these communities were. It's not like you never saw your daughter again. You saw her probably every day of your life. She lived right two houses down. You know what I mean? So this was not like shipping your daughter off to Cambodia someplace. This was essentially a pre-arranged marriage that also had a financial perk for the family, because the bottom line is we're in financial situations. They need a servant in their house. Their son needs someone to marry when he reaches of age. So I will sell you my daughter as a servant to serve in your house. And servants in the Hebrew world were treated with certain rights. They had rights and they had privileges. They also had some tough situations as well, but it wasn't like it was being sold like we would consider early black slavery was here in this nation, or even worse than that, Irish slavery. This Irish people who were sold to black people in Africa was far worse than any situation white people did with black people in this nation. Nothing along that line. I mean, God had laws set in place that didn't allow for that kind of thing to happen. Okay, but nonetheless, yes,
What was the age of marriage for men? For
usually about the age of about 30. Well, the reason why is because they wanted them to be independent of their father's home and already somewhat established.
Boy, that was...
Yeah, there was a good 20-year, almost a 20-year gap in the age. So and so it was not an uncommon thing for to have widows in Israel, because of the fact that, you know, if he starts off, you start off with a marriage with a husband that's 25, 26 years older than you are, it's good chances are, if everything plays out normally, he's probably going to kick off before you do. So that was thus another reason why, not one, the only reason by any means. God was just concerned about his daughters. But it's another reason why those laws were in place for widows and for orphans. So, okay, now, so this selling of one's daughter would most likely not occur if her family were not in financial difficulty. That the girl was purchased for the future purpose of marriage is made clear in these verses by the fact that the verse tells us that if the owner changes his mind and does not espouse her to himself or to one of his sons, he must allow her to be redeemed or bought back by her father. He cannot simply just sell her for profit to some stranger or foreigner, right? She retained the rights and privileges of a Hebrew woman. See, there's protection there, right? If she comes of age and is no longer desired for whatever reason, her master must let her be redeemed by her father or a surviving brother or something like that, and it was incumbent upon them to do so. It's not like he could go and say, you know what, I've changed my mind, or, you know, or any number of reasons why, but I've decided I'm not going to espouse your daughter, I'm not going to marry your daughter, or my son passed away and I had brought her in my home, again, going to espouse her to my son, he's no longer living. I have no purpose for your daughter anymore. It's not like the father or the son, brother could just say, nah, don't want her. God was kind of leaning on them saying, you know what, if you've got the financial means, you must buy her back. Okay. Now, if they didn't have a financial means, other compensations could be made. But the bottom line is, it was incumbent upon the males of the family from which she came to bring her to purchase her back.
Right.
yes. And again, he cannot sell her to foreigners, especially after having been dishonest and failed to perform his duty in paying for her in the first place. Because you also need to understand that in that day, these rights here for women were seen as privileges. Most societies, women were treated as no better than a dog. Or in fact, if you had an ox, it was definitely more valuable than a woman was. You know, I mean, by far, you could make money with the ox. You know, the wife is just, you know, they're a dime a dozen. You can just pick another one up. If the Bible was being influenced by society, that would have been the law here. As it is, there were laws in place protecting her. So this was revolutionary, if anything, right? You also need to understand that the further back you go, the closer to Adam you get, the more right our thinking was. Women wanted to get married, and they wanted to bear children. They wanted to. It was their heart. It was, to them, it was one of the very purposes and why they were created. And if they don't wind up bearing children, they felt like, I'm nobody as a woman. So for her, a girl to be espoused to a man, even if she'd never met him before, she was honored. She did not look at this as like, oh my gosh, I'm being treated like cattle. No, she was honored. And so you need to understand that if later on, when she reaches an age, if the one that purchased her changed his mind, she personally feels shame. And so God made a provision for her that she must be redeemed back, purchased back. Value is on this woman, brought back into the family. You are valued, and therefore I have to spend money to bring you back into my family. You see what I'm saying? This was giving her and maintaining honor for her. Do you see what I'm saying? So we have to not hear it with a Western mindset, because we're so overprivileged it's sick, and we don't have right thinking. Are you following? So we have to hear things the way they would have heard it and understood it. if he does give her to one of his sons, he must deal with her as if now as if she were one of his own daughters. If the son married another in addition to this girl, then he must not neglect her maintenance and upkeep. This included, but was not limited to, her food, her clothing, her habitation, conjugal obligations, the whole nine yards. He could not diminish that in any way. Okay? So in other words, if the father had brought this girl into his home, had purchased her as a servant for the home, eventually to give her to his son as a wife, at this point it was not considered wrong for a man to have more than one wife. And so the son had decided, like Jacob, he had both Rachel and Leah, didn't he? If he wound up marrying somebody else, and say he, like with Jacob, he loved Rachel, wasn't so wild about Leah, he had no real say on that one, then he cannot treat Leah with disrespect. Everything she had before this other woman came into his life, she keeps. Are you following? If she had a certain way of living, you maintain that certain way of living. It's in your if it's in your possibility to do it. You see to it that she's provided for. You see to it that she's got housed and clothed and everything else. And also, this is literally one of the places where Paul drew his statement in 1 Corinthians 7, where it talks about the fact that the husband is not to deny the wife sexual gratification, and neither is the wife to deny the husband sexual gratification. That we are to, that once you're married, your mates are do that. And that's what this passage was also addressing. That young man cannot say, well, I'm really not that interested in her. It doesn't make any difference. You know, she's got sexual needs and you meet them, period. No one's asking you, we're telling you. Are you following? So this was, these were, again, provisions for this woman. Otherwise, she could have just been stuck on the side and, well, I have to make sure you're clothed and fed, but I don't have to show you any affection. No. God would not put up with that. Are you hearing? So this was good. These were good laws. Now, if the son failed in his appointed duties, any of the ones I just mentioned, she is to be set free with no redemption money, since he has failed her in his responsibilities to her. In other words, it does not fall upon her father to have to buy her back. The shame is on the man. And she's to be set free into the custody of her family underneath male headship of her father or surviving brothers or whatever. No redemption price is to be paid because it was the failing of that son that kept her from staying. Are you following? So if he did not maintain those things, she was allowed to walk away with no redemption price. Again, this was a provision for a woman. Okay? Keeping her from being abused or neglected. Okay? So, let's see. While to a modern woman this might seem as if she were being treated as nothing better than property, to the average person at that day it would have seemed as though she possessed unprecedented rights and protected freedoms. One thing that must be kept in mind, I already said that, so I didn't realize I wrote this down because this is from last week. God, all the way through the Old Testament, makes a big deal about the fact that the way that marriage is supposed to be sustained, and he protects the female's rights, and God is a quick answer against a man that does not treat his wife the way he ought to treat her. Bible tells us that we're supposed to give her respect and give her our strength as to the weaker vessel. We're supposed to dwell with our wives with understanding. And if we do not, our prayers will be hindered. God's saying, if you do not have an ear to hear her, I don't have an ear to hear you. That's a big deal. Right? That's what dwell with your wife with understanding means. In other words, have an open ear. Listen to her. Hear what she has to hear. Say, let her, you need to be in the same way that I as God am a refuge to you as the head of your family. You need to be a refuge to your wife as the head of your family, right? And she needs to be able to come to you and you need to know her. And if you don't, your prayers are going to be hindered. Yes, uh-huh.
Well, I've got a combination of question and thought that came. The prayers that he would pray, not only for himself, but for others,
mm-hmm.
would be hindered so that the other people may not get things answered because of the fact that he's not fulfilling what later comes as the effectual affirmative prayer of a righteous man.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Because he's definitely not acting righteous. Another thing that's brought up that kind of falls into that is the fact that God says, if you don't dwell with your wives like this, he says, you are treating her treacherously. And the Lord is a stern witness against you. He said, and the wife of your youth, she is your companion by covenant. See, God saw them not as an ownership, but as a companion. Someone God made Eve for Adam. That was considered a gift. The Bible says if a man who finds a wife has found a good thing and has obtained favor from God. So these are all God's putting his stamp of approval on the role that a woman plays in a man's life and a protection for the woman that the man needs to make sure that he honors his wife and loves her, right? So, and we see those same words in different ways echoed in the New Testament, don't we? The Bible tells the wife, you need to make sure you honor your husband, and husband, you see it, you love your wife, right? Don't allow your eye to be pulled away to somebody else. So anyway, okay, now verses 12 through 14 in the same passage in chapter 21. If someone murders another, they are to be put to death, period. If someone is killed unintentionally, either through some passionate altercation or accident, God was here seeing to it that such a person had a place to flee to for safety. We've talked about that before. They're called cities of refuge. It was not without its limitations, though, since his entire lifetime now had to be lived inside that city. If he ever walked outside of that city, the grieving spouse or brother or children, you're open game. They could kill you, right? In other words, if you get into an altercation with someone else and unintentionally they are killed in that process, God paid attention to the fact that this was not premeditated murder. This was an accident, right? And so I'm not going to charge you with murder. I'm not going to hold you guilty. But at the same time, I acknowledge that the family's grieving over this. And so I've got a cities of refuge. You can flee to that and stay there in safety. But if you ever leave the gate of the city, you're open game. Right? So it was a provision kind of for both, in a way. Right? Yes, uh-huh.
It's not just for an altercation. We had mentioned something about like an axe head flying off its handle, mm-hmm. and it hits someone and kills them.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same situation.
You're right. That's right. Absolutely.
Like, it's not like we got in a fight and I accidentally killed you.
Yeah.
It was...
just something accidentally happened. Yeah.
Right. We were walking and I gave you a little push and you fell down.
A series of stairs and killed yourself. Yeah. So, okay, and also, if it is premeditated, they have no refuge as at God's altar, but must be put to death. And that was the reason why that was necessary to be said, is because, again, God was coming against customs of other lands. That if a person had committed murder, even premeditated murder, they could run to the altar of their God and claim some type of refuge. And God's like, you know, if you did this premeditatedly, you've got no recourse at my altar. You are to be killed, period, right? So again, God not running with the current status quo of the day, but rather going against it. Are you following? So now if anyone strikes or curses either of his parents, he is to be put to death. This is the same as lashing out at God, because God is the one that placed you in that home, period. If you lash out against your parents, speak against them, rail against them, or hit them, you die. That's it. Well, you know, if we still practice that today, there'd be a whole lot less disrespect going on, don't you think?
Yeah,
a lot less. And there's still cultures that do this. If anyone kidnaps someone else and sells them or is still found in their possession, it is to be punished by death. If in a quarrel a man is injured and cannot work, the one who hurt him will not be punished, but must compensate the man for any lost wages until he recovers and pay for his full recovery. If there's any type of medical whatever, it's incumbent on the person that hurt him to pay for his medical needs. If a servant is struck and dies, then the owner must be punished. Now, the question might be asked, why not killed? And the reason is because he is the owner. And the life of the servant belongs to the master. He can't take something that isn't... He's not taking something that doesn't belong to him anyway. Are you following? So now God said, you're going to be punished for it. But I'm not going to kill you for it. Because, see, if I came up and I just killed somebody that didn't belong to me, that's murder. And the reason why it's murder is because I'm taking a life that doesn't belong to me. But if someone is owned by you, that's not the same thing. I can't take something. That's not taking something that doesn't belong to me. I mistreated something. I did something I should not have with something that I own. But God's not going to treat it as though you didn't own it, because you did. So it's punishable, but not by death. Are you following? Mm-hmm. Okay? So, I mean, again, everything God does, what did I tell you last week? All of these laws are based upon his character. And not only upon his character, but upon his person. It all points, but see, we think laws are about making life fair for us. And that's where we miss it. That's not what laws were there for. Laws were there to cause man to understand who God is and our relationship to him. So when God told, whenever God told someone to, you know, go in and kill everybody in the land, and if God told you to do it, it's not murder. The reason why is because all those lives belong to him anyway. Now, if I were to take those lives without God's stamp of approval, now it's murder. Why? Because I've taken something that belongs to God. But if God says, I've delivered them into your hand, that's not taking anything. Is everybody with me? This is the same things we've talked about before when it comes to do with vengeance. God says, vengeance is mine, I will repay. So if you take it upon yourself to incite vengeance, you have stolen from God. That belongs to him, right? All life belongs to God. But if God, through laws, has delegated authority over certain people, this is the reason why this worked with kings. Remember when David did numbered all of Israel, which he was not supposed to do, and he knew he was not supposed to do it. He took a census. This was a big crime. This was a big deal because God had spoken against it multiple times. That alone makes it a crime. But also God had said that he was going to multiply the people beyond number. And so for you to go and assign a number to them is to call in question God's promise. Are you following? And so by doing that, God made that something that was punishable by death. Now, with David, he migrated that sentence, and instead a good number of people in the Jewish nation died because of David's sin. You're like, well, why should people underneath David be punished for David's sin? Because those people being under David were owned by David. Remember, what did God say? If you get a king, he will be to you as God. Meaning, if they're under you, he owns you. Hello? So this is a big deal. We need to understand what we're doing, right? So, you know, and we saw that same thing happen with David's son when he took Bathsheba and he had that man killed, and he went into Bathsheba. The son that was born of that union died. Not because of any sin the child done. The child was just born. It was because of the sin of his father that he died. Right? So, you know, and when that baby appeared before God, God didn't apologize. God said, you know, it's the way things are. Your father who owned you sinned, and I required your life as a requisite for his sin. Period. And God didn't need to apologize for that. So, you know, so if we approach the Old Testament, or really anything that God has done, but specifically the laws that God established, and try to judge them in terms of fairness for humans, you're going to, before long, be looking for loopholes. Because you're not going to be able to justify that with God is love, and yet it doesn't seem to be fair to me. But if you recognize that was never the intention of laws in the first place, well, then all of a sudden now, you don't have that problem. You don't run into that difficulty in your theology. Are you following what I'm saying? This is very important. Now, let's see. If a servant recovers in a few days, now it says, I'm sorry, if he strikes a servant and he dies, then the owner must be punished. But he's not to be killed. If the servant recovers in a few days, no punishment is required. If in an altercation a pregnant woman is hit, but no real injury is sustained, the one who hit her must pay whatever fine her husband sets. If injury to the woman or to the child occur, the punishment extracted will meet the injury of the other party, an eye for an eye, a tooth for the tooth. Okay? If a slave is hurt so that they suffer the loss of any body part, they must be set free. Again, that's a protection for the servant. In other words, if you're the kind of guy that's going to do this in the first place, now if they die, you can't set them free. They're dead. But, you know, but if they're the kind of person that would hurt a person to that degree anyway, God's like, you know what? Before you can do any more damage, you have to set them free. Period. You lose your rights as an owner because you're not a very good one. Are you following? So it was a protection. If an ox gores someone, it must be put to death and not eaten. If the ox was not in the habit of this, no punishment is to be given to the owner. If someone is killed by an ox that was in the habit and was known, and it was known to the owner that it was in the habit of doing this, and if the animal was not properly restrained by his owner, both the ox and the owner are to be put to death. In other words, if you owned an ox and you knew it was in the habit of doing this kind of thing, and you didn't restrain it, and someone died because of your negligence, not just the ox, but you too die. Mm-hmm. Right?
That would change the outlook a lot of people have. These dogs that they trained to kill.
That's right. If a gored person or family member of one who dies requires only a ransom, it must be paid in place of his life. So the family that is been affected could require just a ransom to be paid rather than the person's life. If the injured or killed party were a slave, he must give 30 shekels of silver to the slave's master, and the ox is still stoned. Now, laws of compensation are in this chapter and in as you go forward in the law, essentially follow this rule. If you break it, you buy it. That's essentially the law that God set up. If a man digs a pit or removes the cover off of a pit and an owned animal of value falls into it and dies, it must be paid for, but the dead animal will be rewarded to the one who uncovered or dug the pit. In other words, if I uncover a pit or I dig a pit and I don't do anything to mark it, and your animal falls into it and dies, I got to pay you for it, but I get to keep the animal. Okay? If your ox kills my ox.
Mark, excuse me. Even
yes.
If it was premeditated, would that make a difference?
It doesn't say anything about that. I think that it's kind of implied that it wasn't, but in the end, I don't think it really matters because we're still just dealing with an animal life. It's not a human life. So at that point, premeditated, not premeditated is of very little value. If your ox kills my ox, you must sell your ox. You must sell your ox, split the money with me, and we divide the dead ox for food. If this was the habit of the beast and you did nothing to restrain it, you must buy me a new shiny ox. And keep the corpse. You're stuck with a dead body. Right? Okay, so those were the laws in chapter 21. Any questions, statements? Okay, going on to chapter 22. If an ox or a sheep are stolen and killed or sold, the thief must pay 5 ox for every 1 ox stolen and 7 sheep for every 1 sheep stolen. Okay? Now remember, the rule is, if it's stolen and sold or killed. In other words, I stole it, but I can't redeem it to you because I killed it, or I sold it to somebody else and I don't even know where it is anymore. Right? Therefore, it's not in my possession as the thief. I can't give it back to you because it's gone. Right? So the law is in that point, I got to give you 5 oxen for every 1 ox I killed or stole and sold, or 4 sheep for every 1 sheep. I'm not sure how that played out, if it was a goat or if it was a whatever or a donkey. It doesn't tell you. But obviously there was at least some type of a value that was placed on things. So, Virginia.
Oh, no, you corrected it.
Oh, okay. If any livestock is stolen and found in the thief's possession, he must restore double. If I took your donkey and you found that your donkey was taken by me, I had in my possession, I not only had to give you back your donkey, I had to go get you another one. Right? Okay, a robber breaking into a house at midnight might, a house owner might, in self-defense, kill the stranger without guilt. And the reason, presumably anyway, is that there was no internal lighting back then, and so seeing would have been poor at best, and so one would have to assume the worst of one breaking into their house in the middle of the night. In other words, you protect your family, right? You can't tell what the person's doing. And in the middle of the night, it's hard to cry out for help. Even if you did cry out for help, everybody else is in the dark too. It's not like there's street lamps out there, you know? The chances of being able to get help in the middle of the night is negligible at best. So if a thief breaks in and dies as a result, you're not held guilty for that. If it happens during the day and you kill them, there's a problem. Okay? So you can tell, obviously, the reason must have been poor seeing. You didn't know what to do. You couldn't have called a neighbor. Even you could have called a neighbor, how could they find you? You know, I mean, it's as dark as the inside of a calf out there. So you got to, you know, there's only so much you could do. So presumably because other means might have been employed, including crying out for help if it was done during the day. So if someone, if it did happen during the day, killing the thief would be considered murder. And he, it says, let's see, it might be including credit for it. In every case where a thief could not make restitution, he was sold as a slave for the usual term of 6 years. If anyone sets a grazing animal free to feed on his own land, but it winds up feeding on somebody else's land, he must restore all lost from the very best of his own personal harvest. He couldn't just take the same percentage, but take it from the lowest end of his field. He had to take the best of the best, beyond first fruits, whatever didn't belong to God, the best of the best, and repay out of the best of his field. Right? So, and again, do you remember back when we were going through some of the things that Brother Rob was taking us through with raising kids God's way? And it talks about structured consequences. And one of the things that you always did was you always, if something had to be done in form of restitution, you always gave the best, not the least. Well, this is a biblical principle, isn't it?
Right.
Yes. Right? So, if anyone starts a fire that destroys another person's property, full restitution is required. If someone entrusts personal goods into the safekeeping of his neighbor, and it is stolen while it is in his trust, if the thief is found, he has to restore double, just like we read earlier. If the thief is not found, the entrusted neighbor will be tried by the judges to determine if he was the thief himself. If the goods were livestock and they die or are hurt or are claimed to have run away, the owner and the entrusted neighbor must make an oath before the Lord that it was not on purpose or stolen, and the owner must accept this as the truth. If it is later found out that it was in fact killed or stolen by the neighbor, he must make full restitution for it. If the livestock was killed by another animal, the remains were to be provided as proof that that happened, and no restitution was necessary because it was an accident. It was something that was not through neglect or anything like that. If someone claims to have suffered a wrong from his neighbor in anything, whether it be his possessions or livestock or pets or whatever, it was to be determined by judges, and the one determined to be the guilty party would have to restore double what was lost. In other words, if it was my word against your word, Virginia were to claim, Mark did me wrong and I lost this as a result of it, she had to take her claim before the judges. The judges would judge between her and I, and they would judge as to whether she was lying about it or whether I was really guilty. And whoever was the guilty party had to repay the other one double whatever was claimed to have been lost. So in other words, if it was deemed that her accusation was false, then I wind up getting free donkeys or free sheep or whatever because they deemed her to be the liar. Are you following? So, let's see. If a man has sex with a non-married, non-engaged woman, now this is important because, and I've told you this before, the way they viewed things was, and this was by God's established law, if a person gives their word and pledge, it's as good as done. Are you following? So if I were to have espoused what we call engagement, there was no backing out of engagement. When you were engaged, it was the same thing as married. You just can't have sex yet. Right? Are you following?
Yeah.
That's remember, and that you asked that question, I think, during Christmas about whether or not why Joseph espoused Mary, during her virginity, because he didn't want it to look like she had gotten pregnant outside of marriage, because he didn't want to bring shame on her. But he was only espoused, and he went ahead and did in fact get married, but they didn't conjugate the marriage until after, of course, the birth of Jesus. But you need to understand that again, I'm being very careful to not say this culture, lest you think it was a cultural thing. This law was in place because of the fact that she had to not just not be married, she couldn't even be a spouse because it's the same thing. Are you following? Okay. So now if a man had enticed a woman to have sex with him and she was a spouse to be married, this was adultery. Okay? But she was, if she wasn't the spouse to be married, she was just a virgin. She was not spoken for on any level. And you encouraged her, and she gave in to your charms, and you wound up having sex, you got to marry her. Period. That's all there was to it. But if she had been espoused or if she'd been married, now it's adultery, and we got different laws for that. You see why I've said all this? Yes. Huh? Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, and we get into further things about that later when we get into the law that goes into more specifics about this. Okay? But anyway, if a man has sex with a non-married, non-engaged woman with her consent, then he is obliged to marry her. If her father will not allow the marriage... Now notice, God is bowing to the rights of who he sees as the owner, her father. You see what I'm saying? If the father says, now God says, I'd like them, they should probably just get married. But if you as owner, because I delegated authority to you, I'm not going to take that authority away from you as father. If you say, I don't want this marriage to take place, then it doesn't take place. God's not going to usurp, he's not going to take his authority away from the man, he already gave it to him. Right? Are you seeing? So he's going to honor the man's viewpoint. If he does not want her to get married to this guy, then she's not going to get married. In this case, then the man must pay the price of the dowry of virgins. This means that he was to pay the father just as much for the disgrace brought upon him by the seduction of his daughter as maidens would receive for a dowry upon their marriage. That's what he had to pay the dad. The seduction of a girl who was betrothed to be punished, I'm sorry, but a seduction of a girl who was betrothed was punished much more severely, and we'll deal with that when we get into the book of Deuteronomy. Now, the next thing that's brought up is kill all the witches.
Can I ask a question before you move on?
Yes.
Do you know what happened to the girl, say, the virgin, and she succumbed to his charms?
Mm-hmm.
But the father wouldn't let them marry. What happened to her?
To be honest with you, I'm not entirely certain. Because she had already breached her virginity, it's very possible she may not have been able to ever marry.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
I don't know for sure. The reason why I call that into question, and there's so many laws, I don't retain all of them in my head, so forgive me on that. But the only reason why I question as to whether or not that's possibly wrong is because just because a woman had been married before did not mean that she could not remarry under certain circumstances. I don't think this was one of them, okay? So chances are she would have remained a virgin in her father's house for the rest of her life, more than likely, okay? So, but I'm not saying thus saith the Lord on that.
Yes.
I'm saying based on what I believe to be true. We may find out that that's wrong later. Okay, so kill the witches. According to Spiro Zodiades, our understanding of the word witches is rather incomplete, but at very least we know that it involved the use of supernatural powers to, in competition against God's power in order to sway the heart from being persuaded by God's wonders. One of the examples that we see of this that we've already read was Pharaoh called upon his sorcerers to do the same thing that Moses was able to do by the miraculous power of God. And it was... this was being pitted against God's power to convince that this isn't any more powerful than we are. You see what I'm saying? So, but one way or the other, it's conjured supernatural things that are done by demonic spirits. It's not done by God, okay? So it could definitely be, could fall into the category of what you and I would call wizardry or sorcery or witchcraft or any number of other words would fit into this basic idea, okay? So, and this is addressed also in Exodus 22:18. King Manasseh's involvement in sorcery, and we read about him just the other day. Remember, I mentioned the fact that King Manasseh is one of the ones who caused his own sons his own children to pass through the fire and to Molech. he actually led Judah to the breaking point of God's patience. And one of the ways that he did that was by consulting mediums and sorceries and wizards. So it's consulting the dead, necromancy through sorcery and stuff like that. So and divination, all of that. God says all those practices, whoever practices that, they're put to death. Period. However, There is one exception to this, and that was in Daniel chapter 2, verse 2. In a pagan country where sorcery was practiced with greater ignorance, Daniel acted to save the magicians from death while demonstrating God's power exceeded that of the sorcerers. So in other words, because they were Gentiles and they were doing what they were doing in ignorance, he made moves to see to it that they were not put to death. You see what? And that would be just like God. Because if you do something in ignorance, it's not sin, right? But Israel had no excuse. They all knew it was sin. Now, sex with animals was punishable by death. End of story. There was no bestiality in Israel, because if it was ever done and found out, you died for it. That was all there was to it. Anyone who offers sacrifices to another god is to be killed, and all of his possessions were to be destroyed. So not only were they killed, but your estate was destroyed. There was no remnants left of you. Period. It was done. Yeah, you know, the other answer to this is a man that honors the Lord. The Bible says that their memorial will never cease. God will cause their name to be known on the earth. But if someone in covenant with God bows down to another god, he will cause their name to cease off the earth. Period. He'll snuff them out and even destroy their estate. Period. There's nothing left of you. Right? So, and again, we're not looking... Again, this isn't about what's fair to man. This is about what's right. Are you following? I hope that helps you. Because I'm telling you, I guarantee that as you go forward in God's Word, this will help you a lot if you understand that. Do not oppress or treat violently any stranger. That means any Gentile. Remember that you didn't like it when you were treated that way in Egypt. Well, that's fair. That's essentially do unto others, isn't it? Jesus' interpretation of this was do unto others as you'd have them do to you, right? You knew what it was like to be picked on in Egypt. Don't do that to somebody else. Just because they're a stranger and different than you, don't pick on them. Do not oppress, afflict, or make life difficult for the fatherless or for the widow. If you do, and they cry out to God in any way, I'll kill you. Well, there you have it. You know, God's pretty cut and dry about these things, isn't he? You know, I mean, but notice who he's protecting, those widows, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's protecting the fatherless. If you make their life difficult and they cry out to me, you're a dead man. It's over with. Now, if it was a false accusation, God would know that. He said, if you actually do it, right? And not just if you do it, but if they cry out. Now, if you do it and they don't cry out, God may or may not do anything. Because God expects you to ask for help, doesn't he?
Yes.
Yes.
This is a silly question, but when he says, I will kill you with the sword.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's very likely that, in other words, he would have had the judges do it. It could be more metaphorical, saying, I'll do it myself. I'm not entirely certain. No, it's not a dumb question at all. And to be honest with you, I can't be absolutely certain about the answer to it. But that is if you oppress, afflict, or make life difficult. If you just do any of those things, the gig's up. If they cry out to me, I will kill you. And therefore, how's that justice? Because by killing you, I'm now going to place your wife in the position of being the widow and your children in the position of being the fatherless. You thought it was funny. Picking on the fatherless and the widow. How funny are you going to think it when it? How funny you're going to think it is when it's your wife that's the widow and it's your children that are the fatherless? Hello? Justice. Sounds like justice to me. Right? So, if you lend money to your Hebrew brother, do not charge interest. You may keep something as surety or collateral. But if that piece of collateral is something that they need to live, the interesting example that's used here is essentially PJs, what you sleep in. Because he's talking about clothes that you wear at night when the sun goes down. He says he needs to have that back before he goes to bed, or he's going to be naked when he goes to bed. Don't take the man's PJs. Or if you do, just keep his PJs during the day and give it back to him at nighttime so he can sleep in some clothes, and then he has to return them back to you in collateral in the morning. But in other words, if it's something that a person needs, while they need it, let them have it, and then it's returned to you for collateral until the debt is paid. That's essentially what the rule is. Okay? And notice, what was God's reason for this? He says, because I'm gracious. See, this isn't based on what's fair for you. It's based on my character. It's based on who I am. And therefore, I understand it's your collateral, but if this is his ox and he needs it for plowing because it's the time of the season for plowing, give it back to him during that time period. After plowing's over, he has to give it back to you for collateral. And the reason why I made this law is because I'm gracious.
And he is.
Right? Amen. God's good. You are not to treat lightly or dismissively or verbally curse or place verbal obstacles in the path of any ruler or governor. Now, your Bible might say, speak against any gods. The word gods there is better translated rulers, which is why you'll see it's a form of parallelism. In that passage, it'll say gods, and then it says it in another way later, and it uses the word governors or rulers. That's what it's talking about. In other words, this is exactly where Paul got that we don't give raise a riling accusation against governors and rulers. We don't do that. That's written in the New Testament. Where do you think he got that? The law. It's right there. It's not the God. Now you need to understand. You could translate that word, that same word as gods, but God would never have told Israel, "Don't speak a word against another god," because they're nothing. That's right. Because another god is nothing. It means nothing. But God did, because remember, everything is from God's perspective. So these other gods are nothing anyway. If you speak against another god, you're speaking against air. It doesn't exist. There is no other god, right? However, if you speak against a ruler or a governor, I place them there. Are you following? Don't do that.
There's a lot of people breaking that one right now.
There's a lot of Christians that do that regularly.
That's what I meant. A lot of Christians.
Oh, you're right, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. You are right. And God is very much against that. The New Testament's very much against that. Yes?
The interpretation in the King James said, mm-hmm. thou shalt not revile the gods.
Mm-hmm.
And the explanation was God with a capital G.
No, that's not what it means.
That's not right.
It's definitely in the plural, number one. And number two, it's definitely talking about. Read the rest of that verse.
Thou shalt not revile the gods, nor curse the ruler of thy people.
Okay, see, it's parallelism. You guys remember me talking to you about parallelism? I mentioned that many times in here. It's a form of writing in Hebrew where you say the same thing a different way, one right after the other. Okay? So when he says gods and then ruler of your people, those are synonymous terms.
Synonymous. Okay.
Okay? So, we do hear that from Paul, don't we? Not to bring a riling accusation against, and then in the book of Jude, it says that people who are who fall away from the faith and apostate themselves from God are the same kind of people that bring riling accusations against rulers and speak things that they ought not, right? So it's and he talks about how they're insubordinate, and Paul talks about the fact that we're supposed to pray for our leaders and to bless them and not curse, right? So these are all very important. Yes.
Okay, we have in this country pretty much two opinions.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we're supposed to pray for our leaders,
mm-hmm.
but what about having differences of opinions,
mm-hmm.
of those that are of the opposite belief? Say those that are.
You can maintain a different belief than them. You just don't speak against them. It doesn't say. Nothing says you can't voice that, based on my understanding of Scripture, I can't agree with the decision that our ruler is making. I guess you could make that statement because you're not condemning the person. You're not calling them stupid. Now, if you did, now you've crossed the line. You're attacking their character. But one way or the other, the Scripture is very clear that we pray for them, we bless them, we do not curse them, and that we walk in obedience with them. Whether we agree with them or not, and which we see Jesus doing all the time, right?
Like she said, with the times we're in right now and mm-hmm. what's going on is a...
Oh, yeah. But that's really always been true.
Yeah, but it's good to have that presented again.
You're right.
Because you get so caught up in it.
You're right. And one of the reasons why you get caught up, one of the reasons why Christians get caught up into it is the complete opposite reason why God said he was not ashamed to be called Abraham's God. Christians begin to place their hope in this world, in this kingdom, as though this was their kingdom. And it's not. God's like, this isn't even your kingdom. What are you worried about what they do? Who cares if tomorrow they outlaw Christianity? What do you care? That's not your problem. Your allegiance belongs to another kingdom. What difference does it make? I mean, you can't legislate righteousness. I mean, that didn't work for God's own people.
Right.
And the truth of the matter is, how could we legislate righteousness when half the body of Christ isn't walking righteous? How can we demand that we make laws that unrighteous people walk righteously when we can't even get the church to walk righteously? Right? Now we're just hypocrites. Right? You can't legislate that kind of thing. And really, to be honest with you, if there's any place on the planet that should be intuitively understood to be the wrong course of action is in America, because we claim it's a free nation. Well, if it is free, well, that means that you've got a right to do what I don't agree with. You've got a right to live unrighteously. So what right do I have to make it a law that you have to do what my Bible says? Well, that's not free anymore. Hello? It's decidedly not free if someone else tells me what I have to do. I mean, you and I would cry foul if it were someone from ISIS saying, you got to bow down and do this and do that. We're like, no, you can't allow that in the schools. But we want people to do our Christian thing in schools. I'm sorry, it's free. If it goes one way, it can go the other way too. Or both have no place, period. Are you following? I mean, either that or you just need to change the premise for the nation, which is really a bad premise in the first place, because there is no such thing as absolute freedom. You can't have that. There's no such thing as absolute freedom. That doesn't exist. Absolute freedom is anarchy. Everybody does what they want to do. That's absolute freedom. That doesn't work. You have to have laws, which means you're going to tell people to do things they don't want to do. There's no such thing as a free nation. Such an idea is a ludicrous idea. Yes.
It's kind of funny because we do call foul because the Islamic people are saying that we need to start respecting their Islamic laws.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right.
You know, they want their women to go into places and keep their faces covered when our law says you can't do that.
That's right.
They go to Walmart. I think they wanted to work at, I don't remember what it was, but they're working at a business that said that you can't have face coverings.
Mm-hmm.
And she's getting all upset because her husband says she's not allowed to be in public without her face covering.
That's right. That's breaking the Equal Opportunity Employment Act, because that is to deny someone employment based on their religious belief. So it breaks down. If you really want true freedom, you're going to have anarchy, which is where our nation is heading towards anarchy, because everybody wants what they want, and that is true freedom. The ironic thing is the thing that our founding fathers came to establish we're going to get, and we're going to wish we never got it. Because we're going to have everybody free to do what they want to do, which means it's going to be a destructive chaos. The only way you can avoid chaos is by establishing rules that tap dance on your freedom.
That was the big challenge of the Constitution.
Yeah.
And the Declaration of Independence. What are we doing? They were looking on down the road.
Yeah.
Saying, this is not going to work.
No, then they knew it wasn't going to work. They said this is only sustainable by a moral and self-governing people,
which they
knew humans aren't.
That's right.
They already knew it was due. That's the reason why when we were listening to the Truth Project, they called it the American Experiment.
Right.
Because that's really all it was. So, but we need to go on. We'd rather get lost in that. But it is important to realize that we come from another kingdom. And we need to not get so hairy about what's going on in this one. So you are not to treat lightly or dismissive or verbally curse or place verbal obstacles in the path of rulers and governors. You will not put off your first fruit offerings. In other words, when it comes due, give it. Don't wait. Right? And this is echoed. Who can tell me a New Testament parallel to this?
Sorry, I was writing. May I ask you a question?
Hold on. Can you hold on to that? Because
yes,
I'm in the middle of this one. It says, you will not put off your first fruit offerings. In other words, when you have first fruits, give it. Don't wait. What kind of a parallel do we hear in the New Testament like that?
Well, it's in your hand to do good.
Give it.
Do it.
And don't, it says, don't wait. Don't put off to tomorrow what you can. If it's in the power of your hand to give it today, do it today. Right? Now, if it wasn't in the power of their hand, God's not expecting it. But if it is in the power of their hand, if they've harvested it already, first fruits, give it to God. Don't wait till tomorrow. Do it now. It's in your power of your hand. Do it. Right? So, yes, you had a question.
And my question is, what if they don't have it?
Yeah, if they don't have it, they can't give it.
But is that still a rule that they're going to have to come up with?
Or? No. First fruits means the first of your harvest.
Okay.
If you wind up having no harvest at all, well, then there's nothing to give.
Okay. And
right?
You can prove it, though. You have to prove
it. Well, yeah, it'd be an obvious thing. People can look at your crop and tell. They can tell if your field was hit by a blight or something. They know that. So, yes, absolutely. But ultimately, of course, this was something that was going to be you're accountable before God for, and he definitely knows. If it is livestock, it will remain with its mother for 7 days and then be given to God on the eighth day, if that's part of your first fruits. You will be separated and loyal unto God. You will not eat animals which were killed and partially eaten by any beast, but you will give the remains of that to a dog. So, a lot of those things have to do with purity laws as well. Not so much purity as in it was bad for you necessarily, because, you know, I imagine if you roasted it, it probably would not have been bad necessarily. It was really more of a matter of mingling things, because symbolism was a big deal in the Old Covenant. And dogs were considered to be scavengers beasts. And so that's the reason why, remember, the Samaritans were considered dogs, right? And the Gentiles were considered pigs, right? So, and it was due to their uncleanness. So God was essentially saying, I don't want you to consume something that is only fit for someone that's unclean, because you are holy. And see, what was the statement? See, one of the ways that we can understand the heart of a passage is reading the context it was written in. What did God just get done saying? He said, you are separated and holy and loyal unto me. Therefore, don't eat an animal that's been scavenged by another one. That belongs to a dog. Are you following? So you're holy unto me. So now, any other thoughts in that chapter? No? Okay, going on chapter 23. The basic rule at the very beginning here is just don't lie. I don't care what sphere it's in, just don't do it. If the lie takes the form of a false witness, or joining with other people in giving false witness, don't do it. Do not kill someone who is innocent or just, because it will not, because God will not justify your actions if you do that. Do not take a bribe, ever, for any reason, because bribes obscure clear understanding of right and wrong, and it pollutes the words of righteousness. In other words, if you take a bribe, or in other words, if you allow for lobbyists, laws can be tweaked. Does that strike home? It can pervert justice, can't it?
Yeah.
Well, we're living in the results of that right now, aren't we? As God knew what he was talking about. He says, don't accept a bribe. Just don't do it. The answer to that is no, right? Do not go with those that are seeking to do wrong. Do not show favoritism to the poor in a lawsuit just because he is poor, but neither are you to deny him justice if it's due him. If you come across anything belonging to an enemy, whether a personal enemy or a national enemy, it makes no difference. You give it back to them. It's not your property. Do you see how this was? Can you imagine what the laws were in other nations? I mean, this level of morality had never been heard of on this planet before the law came. If you see the donkey of someone who hates you. So now we've gone from someone that you consider an enemy to someone who considers you an enemy, right? Someone who hates you. You don't necessarily hate them, but they hate you, right? He says, if you see the donkey of someone who hates you helplessly laboring under a load, and it occurs to you to refrain from helping it due to the hate your neighbor has for you, you must help it anyway. Right? Do not oppress a Gentile who lives among you. Remember how it felt for you in Egypt. God uses that as the basis for his logic again, right? Work and harvest your fields for 6 years, but on the seventh year, don't work your land at all. allow it to produce whatever it will on its own for the consumption of the poor, and then the animals can have whatever is left over from the poor after the poor are done with it. Do your work during the 6 days allotted for labor to be done. But you, your livestock, and your servants must all rest on the Sabbath day. Everybody gets a rest, even the animals. Everybody. Right? Pay strict attention to everything I have told you here. Do not even take the name of other gods upon your lips. Celebrate a feast in my honor 3 times a year, with the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of Harvest, and the Festival of Ingathering. Now, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, you guys are familiar with that. That was when the preparation that they did before leaving Egypt in the month of Abib. And no one was to appear before God empty-handed. You were to have something, right? The Festival of Harvest was first fruits, essentially. Whatever it comes off the field in the first harvest. The Festival of Ingathering was the end-of-the-year harvest. Okay? All of these were festivals unto God. In all 3 of those festivals, all of the males were to appear before God during these times. 3 times a year, all the men represented themselves before God. Okay? All offerings must be unleavened, and no fat is to remain until morning of your offerings. Bring your best of the first fruits to the house of the Lord. Yeah, God's always big on that. Don't you know, remember we heard it earlier with if you damage another person's stuff and you got to give of your harvest to give it to them, give them the best. Don't ever give the least. Always give the best. You know, it's by keeping stuff like this that has put Jews in a position of monetary advancement on this planet.
That makes sense.
They don't give the worst. They give the best. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
They treat others as they ought to, as they wanted to be treated. Right? Because God told them to. Now, even if they're not born again, this is going to work to their advantage. Because as you sow, you're going to
reap.
Isn't that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, do not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. Now, this one's interesting. Especially in the context of the flow, it's like, where did this one come from? Well, there's actually several different answers. I used to personally believe, in fact, until very recently, believe that this was because it was a pagan ritual. But I've come to realize that the basis for believing this was a pagan ritual has gotten to be on thin ice due to more modern archaeological findings. It's very likely that this was more like the last thing we talked about of eating a carcass that's already been eaten on. The reason why is because of the fact that what you have is, in order to prepare this young goat for food, you are killing it and cooking it in the very thing that was supposed to sustain its life. You are mixing life and death and then consuming it. You're mixing life and death and then bringing it into yourself by eating it. Just like eating a half-eaten animal. He says, that's fit for dogs. It's not fit for you guys who are holy unto me. Right? In the same way, it's not fitting to take something that's intended, take something that was intended as food and take what it was going to be sustaining its life and boil it in it and prepare it for your food. You're taking life and death and mingling it together and eating it. In other words, that right there is unholy. It's unsanctified. It's unseparated. You're trying to mingle life with death. Are you following? So again, it goes back to symbolism. God is big on symbolism all the way through the Old Testament. And he makes a big distinction between what produces life and what produces death. And you don't mingle the two. Yes, uh-huh.
What about foods like liver?
Like liver? If the animal's already dead, it's fine. Now, I don't remember whether or not the liver was considered something that was not supposed to be consumed or not. I think that the liver was definitely given in offerings. It was not something that was typically consumed by the person.
They were supposed to consume the whole Passover.
Well, yeah, that's true. You're
so
right.
They ate everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in those cases, I was thinking about the times when they offer up an animal and burn most of it. They clearly were able to eat the liver and stuff like that. There's no question about
that. So even though those are life-giving organs.
Yes, exactly. So they could eat that. That was life-giving. Yes.
Well,
but he was talking about what I'm suggesting is a possible reason for this injunction here is because the milk was the thing that was supposed to give life to this goat, which is why it's saying it's mother's milk, right?
Yeah.
And for you to take the mother's milk and boil its own baby in it, you're mingling death with life and then consuming it. You see what I'm saying? He didn't say it was wrong to do that with another mother's milk. He just said don't do it with its own mother's milk, okay? It was going to be sustained by the life of his own mother, right? By the milk of its own mother. That's very possible. It has been suggested that this was a pagan ritual practiced by other nations. It was even suggested in one of the writings I read that it was an Egyptian practice. But I can't find it anywhere when I do searches in Egyptology. I can't find that practice was ever done. It may have been a Canaanite practice. I have read that, that they would boil a kid in its mother's milk and then use that to sprinkle over a harvest that it might as a sacrifice to their gods for an increased harvest. And if that in case is what God was really addressing, he was essentially saying don't commit idolatry. In other words, don't do this because it's a pagan practice where you're asking other gods to bless your fields. I'm the Lord your God, I bless your fields. So either could be true. I can't come down dogmatically on either one. Whether it's symbolic or whether it was a form of idolatry, God said, "Don't do it," right? So, we're not always going to understand why, but that was definitely one of the reasons. Now, Guzik, I thought that was kind of interesting because Guzik pointed out just how legalistic things can get, because today, strict Jews will not even eat a kosher cheeseburger, and the reason why is because you don't know for sure that the milk that made the cheese was not produced by the mother of the calf you're eating. So they won't do it. In fact, they won't even eat cheese on the same plate or at the same time as meat. Because you can't guarantee it.
Right. They won't store the meat in with the dairy stuff.
Yeah, because they don't understand what this law means, and so we're not going to break it in anyway.
Right.
So we're just keeping as far away from that as possible.
Right.
So unless you made the cheeseburger, you can't eat it. You know, if you made the cheese and you killed the goat and you know they came from different families, great, knock yourself out. But don't do it in public because you don't know. Something that literally is something that modern Jews will not do. I mean, if they're kosher Jews, if they're Hasidic Jews. Now, another one, another thing that is brought up in this chapter, it says, I'm sending my angel before you. This is a little difficult, but I don't think it's really too difficult. I think the angel is actually talking about Joshua, because the word angel just means messenger. It can be translated as anything. It can mean messenger, it can be angel, it could be any number of things. The one thing we know that as we read forward, we do not see, because remember what it says here, is that you're supposed to follow everything it tells you to do, this messenger. Well, as far as we can see all the way through the Old Testament wanderings, there's never an example where an angel appears regularly and says anything to anybody for Israel to follow. Are you following what I'm saying? Angels don't show up every once in a while and tell all of Israel, now this is what you're supposed to do, and you don't see angels leading them against the Hittites and the Amorites and stuff like that. It says very clearly, I want you to obey their words, this messenger's words. Well, I don't see any examples of angels appearing to Israel and telling them directives from God of what they're supposed to do. Are you following? Not during the wilderness wanderings. You see isolated incidents where an angel might say something to an individual, but not to the whole nation. Are you following? Yes, uh-huh.
I have in my notes here, Holy Spirit.
Yeah, very likely not.
No.
No, because Holy Spirit was not sent yet. He wasn't even here during Jesus' ministry. He was only sent after the new birth was made available. So this is almost certainly talking, and you can see also if you keep on reading.
Was not here on earth.
I'm sorry, what?
Was not here on earth.
Well, he's omnipresent, but he wasn't sent.
Okay.
I mean, he was doing work on the earth, even under the old covenant, but he wasn't given. You see what I'm saying? But it's also kind of clear what he's talking about, because he's talking about when you go in and possess the land of Canaan. So this isn't even during the wilderness wanderings. This is when you go and possess the land of the Hittites, the Amorites, all the Ites, right? Well, who did that? Who was the messenger that went before them? Joshua was. right? So I think it's kind of obvious. This has to be Joshua. I can't imagine it being anything else. So now I'm not going to be hard-nosed about that. I'm just telling you that's my belief. So it says, I'm sending my angel, my messenger. I believe it's a reference to Joshua himself, since no mention is made hereafter of Israel seeing, hearing, and following the instructions of the same angel that they all witnessed. When my messenger brings you to all the ites, all the lands of the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, all those, the promised land, do not bow down to their gods and take up the, their practices or strike covenants with them, but completely destroy them and their pillars. They cannot live with you in the land that I'm giving you, because you are to serve me only. And they will only serve to turn your heart's loyalties from me towards other gods. So he goes on, he gives a promise to those that are obedient to all that he has said. He said, I will bless your water and your food, your bread, essentially what you drink and what you eat, and take sickness away from you. There will be no miscarriages. There will be no barrenness. You will live out all of your days. I will send the fear of me, your God, before you, so that people will hear you coming and will be quick to respond whenever you go to take their land, because they're afraid of you. And within 1 year, you will possess the land, lest the wild animals take over the land that I'm appointing to give to each one of your tribes. Now, of course, it didn't work out that way because Israel wasn't obedient. He said, if you will obey, right, I'll do these things. And that included, they would have all of them possessed their lands within a year of taking the promised land. That's not what wound up happening. But the reason why it didn't happen is because they weren't obedient. The condition was obedience, wasn't it? Right? And he said, you know, I'm going to drive them out, and I want you to possess the land very quickly thereafter, because otherwise wild animals will take over the area, and it'll just be all the harder to inhabit. So I want you to drive them out and possess the land quickly thereafter. Also, you're not supposed to take no prisoners. I don't want any of those, the ites, living with you, because they're just going to turn your heart to serve their gods, right? Now, we are now at 10 minutes to closing, so let's see. Does anyone have any questions or statements about what we've already covered? What?
I thought that Joshua encountered an angel.
He may have, but that's not what he's talking about here.
Okay, good.
He said he's talking to all of Israel. All of Israel didn't hear an angel. Right? So, who knows what Joshua did, but Joshua, and again, I'm not being hard-nosed about it. Maybe Joshua isn't the guy, but it's the only person I can think of that was a messenger that was sent before them into the promised land to take the lands. If there is somebody else, I don't see it anywhere in the Bible, okay?
Well, I'm thinking so, maybe like the angel was talking to, or was a messenger sent to Joshua to tell him.
I guess it's possible.
Yeah, it would be like the Lord.
I know how like God worked with Moses. It's possible.
Jesus.
It's possible, but I'm not saying that hard knows one way or the other. My personal belief, it was just Joshua. Because God, in the same way that God was with Moses, God was with Joshua. By and large, I don't think Moses got too many instructions from an angel, and I doubt that Joshua got too many, if he got any, from an angel. He may have. But probably most of his marching orders he got directly from God himself. So chapter 24, God starts off by telling him, he says, Moses, Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, along with 70 of the elders, were to come and worship from afar. Only Moses was to come near to God. Moses wrote down and communicated the commandments to the people, all that God had said. And they all claimed that they would obey everything that God had said to do. Moses rose early the next morning and erected one altar and 12 pillars, one for each tribe, at the foot of the mountain. Moses involved young men by having them offer sacrifices on the altars. Moses took a half of the blood and threw it on the people and said, Behold, the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance with all of these words. Now, the last part of this I'm just going to read. It's verse 9 through 18. Okay. Then Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, Nadab and Abihu are essentially just Aaron's oldest sons. Okay. And the 70 elders of Israel went up, And they saw God, the God of Israel, and there was under his feet, as if it were a pavement of sapphire stone, like the very heaven for clearness. And he did not lay his hand on the chief men of the people of Israel. They beheld God and ate and drank. The Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and wait there, that I may give you the tablets of stone with the law and the commandments which I have written for their instruction. So Moses rose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. And he said to the elders, wait here for us until we return. And behold, Aaron and Hur are with you. Whoever has a dispute, let them go to them. So Moses is passing a mantle here, isn't he? Then Moses went up on top of the mountain, and the cloud covered the mountain. The glory of the Lord dwelt on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. So Moses was up there for an entire week before God said anything to him, right? So again, there's a lesson in the middle of this. That, you know, one of the lessons, that at least that I can get out of it, is that God is not always going to be quick to speak to you. You know, he might call you, and he might call you up to meet with him, but that doesn't mean he's going to start talking right away. You know, you're going to have to, part of this was a testing and a trial for Moses. I know that for a fact. You know, how long are you willing to wait? Am I important enough? Are you hungry enough? Right? So, but anyway, no reason is actually given, so it's part of that speculation. But the glory of the Lord dwelt on the Mount Sinai and covered it for 6 days. And on the seventh day, he called out to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. Now, the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring fire on the top of the mountain in the sight of the people of Israel. Moses entered the cloud and went up into the mountain, and Moses was on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. And that's where we end. We'll pick up with that next week on chapter 25, what comes out of this. But he was up there for a while, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Now, you know, there's a lot of speculation that goes on as to what happened while he was up there, because, you know, if all what was going on was God handing him two tablets, that wouldn't take very long. Certainly wouldn't take a whole day, much less 40. So probably quite a bit went down during that time period. But one thing I can guarantee is that being in the presence of God and beholding his glory for 40 days, Moses was never the same.
I don't think anybody would be the same.
Nobody could be the same. I think that it was a life-changing situation without any question whatsoever. And God, in many respects, needed it to be. So, but we also see at the very beginning of the next, I think it's at the very beginning of the next chapter, that you can have been in the presence of God and still get frustrated. Because the first thing that happens when he comes down, right? So, anyway, any thoughts or statements or questions? No? Are you seeing how very important it is that we recognize that these laws are stated from the perspective of God's justice? They're not based upon man's fairness. It has nothing to do with what's fair to man. It might work out to be fair for you. It might not. Like in one of the examples we read tonight, if one person brings an accusation against another and it's just a he said, she said, it's brought before the judges, and whatever they say, you have to go with. What if they're wrong? You still have to go with it. Period. And nowhere in that passage does it say God will make sure the answer is right. Doesn't say that. Yeah.
It's a situational ethics kind of question.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, I don't know how recent, but anyway, in California, which is an unusual state to begin with, they passed the law that even from the very beginning of school-age children, that mm-hmm. they will now be taught about LGBT, transgenderism, mm-hmm. and sexual preferences, and it's all okay, and so on and so forth. Yeah. And the parents have no choice to opt out of it.
Yeah.
So they're to be Christians and so forth, they're to honor that and abide by it?
If it's a law, yeah, absolutely. You abide by the laws that are established, period. Or you can withdraw your kid and put them in another school.
But God does not sanction gay marriages.
No, he doesn't. But he doesn't sanction half the things that the Roman emperors did with the money they collected as taxes, but Jesus still paid the taxes to fund their illicit lifestyles. He knew that they were going to use it for building you know, monuments to their gods and use their gold to build public bathing houses where they could have sex with multiple people and stuff like that. And Jesus knew that most of the Caesars were homosexuals. Most of them were. And yet, he still paid their taxes.
So if you had a child and you were there, you would say,
I would homeschool them. That's still an option. Well, if I couldn't do that in the state of California.
I don't know that that's still an option.
It may not be. It may not be. You said it's situational ethics, and that's true. If a person is in California and they are not allowed, say that California doesn't have laws that protect homeschool and you can't, and so therefore you have to go to public school, then I would seek the Lord about, God, do I have to live in California? If he says yes, then I already know his answer is, you teach your child what's right, but yes, they attend the school, period.
Yeah, and the taxpayers are still paying.
That's right, absolutely. I understand the moral dilemma, but I mean, let's go ahead and just take it one closer to home. What about the situation of, do I bake a cake for a homosexual? Well, why not? They paid for it. It's not like you're signing the name on their marriage partner, their marriage certificate. You know, it'd be different if you were the one doing the marriage, and therefore, if I were having to do a marriage of a homosexual, that would be different because that is requiring me to participate in their sin. Are you following? Right. Now at that point, now what you're doing is you're trying to force something. You're trying to force me to sin. Right. That's different.
Isn't that the same though with the law for the?
No, a child going in to hear what the world has to say is not forcing the child to participate in the sin. They're just hearing about it.
Well, I doubt seriously that they would just be hearing about it.
If in a classroom,
the law itself. But yeah. I'm just saying if they're requiring them to even, I mean, some schools they require you to, you know, put down your mat and turn to the east and, you know, pray.
Yeah,
however many times.
I understand. No, see, so at that point, see there again, that is answered in the New Testament for us with when Peter and them were sanctioned by the high priest and said, "You no longer preach in his name." He says, "You tell us whether we should obey man or God." At that point, it's sphere authority. At that point, they were trying to make them do something or not do something that God told them specifically to do. That's different, okay? So if someone comes in and says, you have to worship another God, well, then you don't do it. But if someone says, you've got to attend this class, it's a law, and hear what we have to say, well, then you obey the law. Go to the dumb class and hear what they have to say.
Well, our children have to learn the truth and the error, and they're going to be exposed.
It's your job as a parent to teach them the difference anyway.
They're going to be exposed to lies no matter where they're at.
Yeah, I mean,
and they have to learn discernment. And
we have to understand that the world that Jesus grew up in, the homosexuality, the LGBT thing in his day was a million times worse than it is in America.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they had statues of sex organs everywhere. They had people having orgies in the street, and the Jewish people lived there. Jesus saw this with his own pure eyes.
Yeah.
And no one shielded him from it. It was just that you're living on a planet that is
perverted.
Disgraceful.
Yeah, perverted.
God's not saying get used to it. He's just saying, but he's not hiding you from it either. You know, it's there.
Well, I agree with the fact, you know,
yeah,
that you have to be the parents to teach them
accordingly. Yeah,
absolutely.
Based
on God's law and his,
mm-hmm,
his, you know, Ten Commandments and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And raise up a child, like they were saying, that, you know, it's God's way.
Mm-hmm.
I was
it's a good question. It's a good question. And I don't, and it depends on the situation as to what plays out. Like the other example you're giving is if it's required that your child pray to Allah, well, say, no. See, now you've gone through, you've crossed the barrier from just exposing me to something to requiring that I participate in something.
Right.
That's different.
That's right.
And God makes a distinction of that in Scripture without any question, right? And if it puts you in prison, it puts you in prison.
I've not read the law, but I would not be surprised if at some point they would.
Oh, make it mandatory.
To experiment.
Oh yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
And this is right. And
well, they pressure experimenting with same-sex sex now in schools. I know people who specifically would never have gotten engaged in sexual activity with the same sex if it had not been taught them at school.
Right.
It was taught that it was normal, and that was more readily available, and you know, in their state, you couldn't, you know, they couldn't have sex with someone from the opposite sex at that age. But I, but at a slumber party, I can have sex with anybody I want to. I mean, this is rampant in our day. So yeah, and it's a terrible thing, but it is the world we live in. But yeah, this is a very, very good question.
Why do they have to recommend anything?
The state shouldn't have to. And they're breaking their own laws of freedom by forcing it in the first place, which is why I said this is all heading towards anarchy. But, you know, the truth of the matter is the pendulum has just swung to the other side. We used to be forcing people to do the other.
Yeah.
As you say, we can see the writing on the wall.
That's right. I mean, we get upset that people don't want to pray at a football game. But, you know, why should we subject them to praying to God in Jesus' name? Why shouldn't they be able to pray to Allah in Muhammad's name? If it is a free nation, we're not okay with doing that. But they want we want them to be okay with doing it our way. Well, that's not freedom.
So, would you agree with the fact that that statement? This is a different happening. I know we're going down rabbit passage.
Mm-hmm.
That why say one nation under God?
Yeah, why? Because we're really not.
We are not.
No, we are.
Looking around in this society.
No, and the truth of the matter is, depending on what they meant by that original statement, it could be argued that we never were. Because a good portion of the people that signed those papers were deists. They weren't Christians. So, you know, what God are you talking about? So, you know, I mean, it's... You know, it's very, you know, all those things are extremely subjective. Ultimately, what it comes down to is if the Bible makes it very clear that we obey the laws of the land. Now, if the laws of the land require me to participate in unrighteousness, no, I'm sorry. That's where you draw the line. However, you know, if the government requires that I give my taxes to something that is doing something unrighteous, Jesus asks the question, whose inscription's on the money? Well then, if you see a White House on that and not your house, it's their money.
Right.
You're just peddling another man's goods. If they say, I want it from you, give it. Give it. So, you know, I understand it rubs us the wrong way. It rubs me the wrong way.
but by giving your taxes, and then they put this money into different avenues, and say, like, with the Planned Parenthood and the things that they have done as far as the abortion and the killing of babies and so on. And
it's horrible.
And so forth. You're not condoning what Planned Parenthood is doing.
Mm-hmm.
You're just obeying the law.
I mean, but it could be argued by some, and I argued that for a while. That, you know, questioning whether or not it was right to give taxes to the government, knowing that they were going to use it for things that were completely contrary to the kingdom of God. But God does answer that in Scripture, as we all know now. But the truth of the matter is that that could be an honest question. Do I want to place money behind something that I know is going to work against the kingdom of God? My resources are supposed to build the kingdom, not tear it down. So it could be a valid question, and thank God he answered it. It's actually written right there pretty clearly in Scripture. these are good questions. They're not bad questions at all.
Where can you go? What nation could you go?
You can't.
You can't go anywhere that you're not going to be tapped or give money into their coffers.
Mm-hmm. The coffers of people that are doing things you can't agree with.
Yeah.
Even in the best of nations, they're going to do something you can't agree with.
That's exactly.
No. So... you know, and you know, so I'm grateful that God wasn't silent on those things and left us to just guess.
Yeah.
But it is very important that we realize that we are to honor the laws of the land, and that some things that we have wanted to be dogmatic about in the past, I question strongly whether or not we have a right to be dogmatic about them. If it has something to do with you and you're living it, that's a totally different issue, totally different. But you know what? Now, it could also be argued, going back to the cake issue, that if you are an owner of a business, that you've got a right to deny service to anybody because that's part of your freedom.
Yes.
But that becomes more of a national issue than it is a religious issue. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
If as a Christian, I mean, where do you draw the line? Say that I know lots of Christians that say, well, they were right to deny the sale of a cake to a homosexual wedding. Well, what if a liar came in and asked for it?
Well,
Do you deny sales to liars too? Because God says it's the same thing. It's all punishable by death. What if I'm a contractor, and someone contracts me to build their home, but I know that they live a bad lifestyle? Do I say no? I'm not going to build your home because I don't agree with your politics, or I don't agree with your religious beliefs. No, if they're paying you money, build a dumb home.
Or an adulterer.
But you don't have to build them.
As far as freedom in the nation is concerned, you should be free not to. Right. The question that the Christian needs to ask himself is, based upon what am I denying the service? Because the truth of the matter is, if I'm going to deny service based on sin, most Christians I know, I'd have to deny sale to them too. Mm-hmm.
But what if it's a particular sin?
It doesn't make any difference. All sin's the same.
God.
The reality is 90% of the people that they sell cakes to are probably not seen as Mary in God's eyes anymore.
That's right.
Right.
Exactly. Right. I mean, if I'm going to make that the basis for selling a cake to a marriage, then I need to have them fill out an affidavit that this is your first marriage, or if you're divorced, it was for the right biblical reasons, otherwise you're getting married in an adultery, and I'm supporting you by putting a cake behind that.
Right.
You know, I mean, if you really believe this, well, then do it. But if you don't believe that, then sell the dumb cake. What difference does it make to you what they're doing with the stupid cake? They didn't ask you to agree with what they were doing. They asked for a cake.
But you know what I'm saying? The final line would be that we are in this world, but we are not of it.
We're not of it.
That's right.
That's right. Now, again, if we're looking at kingdom-minded, if it goes against that person's conscience, then it goes one step further. At that point, it's not a matter of whether it's just common sense. If it's against your conscience to do it, well, then the law doesn't have a right to tell you to go against your conscience.
Right.
Your conscience may be wrong. It may be conflicted. Like I said, you know, the same person has got a conscience against selling it to a gay couple, but they'd have no problem selling it to people who are getting married outside of what God considers marriage. And they'd have no problem with that. Well, that's clearly a conflict, scripturally speaking, but inwardly, if their conflict is an inward one and they're having to go against their own conscience to do it, well, then you just take it on the chin. If the government says that you're supposed to do it and you don't do it, well, then you lose your business. So, you know, you see, the Bible actually addresses each one of these things. Many times the answer is different than you might have thought it was.
Right.
But, you know, ultimately what God is looking for is for us to live morality, not to demand morality out of other people.
To be
right?
Examples.
And how
we're supposed to be an example.
How much does the cake owner believe in his convictions?
Yeah.
If I can't consciously, do this cake, am I willing to lose money?
That's right.
He did.
That's right.
Yeah.
And he did. Yes.
Yeah.
And again, I don't know these people. I'm guessing that they believe either it's a personal conviction or they are just believing that the Bible would have told them to do this. If it's the latter, they really need to be counseled and need to understand what the scriptures actually say. If it's a personal thing like eating meat, you know, or esteeming one day higher than the next, well, then it would have been wrong for them to sell it because, in fact, they'd be going against their own conscience.
Sure.
See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So it's... rarely are things as straightforward as a one-size-fits-all answer.
Yeah.
Now, there are many, like, don't murder. That pretty much fits everybody, right?
Yeah.
You know, don't commit adultery pretty much fits everybody. But, you know, there are some things that fall into a little bit of a gray area. And so that's the reason why we have to dial it back and not be so quick to pass judgment, right? Now, we all know that the homosexuality is wrong, but whether or not it's wrong to bake a cake for someone who's paying you for it, regardless of the moral stances, seems to me to be kind of common sense, but maybe it's not to some people, and that's okay. But, you know, we just have to be careful. Because, you know, like I said, if we're going to do it based on that, then there's a whole lot of the people you can't sell to. And most of them will actually be Christians that you won't be able to sell to. So, and at that point, people are going to have to fill out an application just to buy a cake, you know? Give you a family history. Yeah. Or fill out a family history just to sell a cake. At that point, you know, at this point, it's just getting kind of silly.
You know, you could have went over there and told them that both of them, because of the husband and wife, if they went over there and told them that, then they probably might have seen some validity what you're saying, and maybe not lost their business.
It's possible.
So.
Yeah. Because I don't even know who these people are, but
that's over their conscience.
Yeah, but it,
well, those
yeah.
kind of things have come up on
on the TV, yes,
two or three times.
Yeah, and see, and the world's going to do everything they can. Of course, this is all going to be the world against the church.
Yeah.
You do know that, because I guarantee that if a Muslim had done the same thing, it would have never popped up as a blip on the radar.
Right.
But if a Christian does it, all of a sudden the world is coming apart, right? Because in the end, this is a battle of darkness against light.
Yes.
There are only two kingdoms here. And we're on the one that they're not on. What's
I'm pretty
that?
Sure that they targeted them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, they did.
They've done that more than
yeah.
one time
yes.
on television.
And it's,
at least
and,
four or five of them.
And you can tell this is a spiritual battle, because if they were really against that thought process, they would have targeted someone who was a Muslim. Because we don't throw
yeah.
homosexuals off of the top of buildings.
Right. That's exactly.
So why not target them?
Yeah. yeah.
Because this really isn't about the issue. It's about light and darkness.
And
because
the
Muslim and they are actually on the same team.
The Muslims hate them. And they
oh, yeah.
put them to death.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And Christians
yeah.
don't do that. They're not supposed
we'll
to do that.
We'll just avoid them and say, no, we're going
yeah.
to deal with that.
So, so
yeah.
you can see that this is actually actually a light and dark issue. It's really not a moral issue.
Yeah.
So, all right, let's go ahead and close in prayer.